Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Glad you're tuned in. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, historian Dr. Tom Easern opens a forgotten ledger of prairie history in Mr. Power's Letterpress, exploring the curious 19th century technology of copybooks and how they preserve business of bonanza farming. Then a climate crisis is hitting the forest. Nebraska's bur oak trees are dying and experts are scrambling to respond. Plus, ocean waves could soon power two remote Alaska villages, and we'll hear how. And in our weekly look at water, potatoes, climate denial, and what your doorbell camera have to do with conservation. And we begin Main Street today by talking about youth sports. It's a topic we've spoken about before here on the show. But the fact is, youth sports can bring out the best and sometimes not the best in families. And while athletes can teach teamwork, discipline, and resilience, blurred boundaries between athletes, parents, and coaches often create stress, conflict, and burnout. Sean Brotherson is a professor of child development and a family life specialist at North Dakota State University, and he recently spoke to the North Dakota High School Coaches Association conference about setting healthy boundaries in youth sports, and that's what we'd like to visit about today. Sean, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
As I said in my intro, you had a chance to speak with North Dakota State High School coaches just last week. What did you tell them?
Well, we had about 2 hours together, and really, the message I wanted to communicate was just about the topic of, like you mentioned already, setting healthy boundaries in that context of youth sports. And specifically, we spent time exploring what is a coach's role in modeling and reinforcing healthy boundaries, what is important to understand about youth in terms of how they're growing and developing, and why healthy boundaries are and things that support that are really important for them. Overall and as well as in a youth sports context. And then talking about as you deal with parents and families who have children involved in youth sports, what are some ways we might think about and work with them so that rather than being at odds with them over how they're going to act or potential concerns about what they might bring to the table, that instead we're focused on what we can do to make them partners and allies in having healthy boundaries with kids in youth sports.
You said that youth sports are often most successful when roles are clearly defined. And we're talking about roles again of athletes, parents, coaches. And I would add a fourth dimension here, maybe school administration. From a parental perspective, certainly from a player's perspective, a long, long time ago, nobody defined any role for me that I can recall. I guess they were thinking it should just be known. It should be common sense. It's not the case.
No, but I think it's become much more common and necessary to communicate what are the expectations that we have for parents and other adults who are supporting kids in youth sports. Everything from how you are behaving and supporting them at practice to how you are behaving and supporting them when they're on the field or in an athletic contest, as well as really what you're doing off the field to support them. And so I think, one of the things I shared was a little placard from, the city of Santa Clara in California. And they have this placard they put up on all their fields. It says, "You are entering the youth sports zone. By entering the youth sports zone, this is what you agree to." So they have stated, these are our clear boundaries, our expectations for you. And it's things like calm down, relax, and enjoy the game, or respect players, coaches, officials, and staff, or celebrate sportsmanship as much as you celebrate performance on the field. Things like that. And it's telling that they felt the need to explicitly outline these standards and expectations for parents and other family members who may be supporting a child involved in youth sports. But I think it's also wise because it helps to do what you just were talking about, which is have a conversation or at least clear communication about what those healthy boundaries might be to create a better atmosphere for the youth involved and for everybody who's involved.
What's the most common role confusion in youth sports that you have come across? And then what are the consequences when those lines blur? Is the consequence only this fight we see that somebody filmed on cell phone that went viral then, you know, hours later? Or are there other consequences that we just don't think enough about?
Yeah, I think the most common blurring of the lines that occurs is parents trying to step into the role of manager of the child's coaching experience, right? Where they are, and very interesting, you've probably talked about this before, but a child's most unhappy experience in youth sports is the ride home from a game. And the reason for that, and there's a lot of research specifically about this, is that during the ride home from the game, many parents cannot restrain themselves from trying to coach the kid up. You should have done this, or this is how you could have done this better, or your coach should have done this. I mean, they're piling criticism and corrective feedback on the child at a time when they just need to hear, hey, it was so great to see you play today. I'm glad you got in the game for 5 minutes. I'm glad you got to take a shot at the goal, you know, if you're playing soccer or something like that. That was awesome. I love seeing you. You know, I hope you had a great experience today. And so as parents are stepping over at the wrong times into that line of, I'm going to manage your coaching experience in your youth sport context, I think that's where lines get blurred. And I'm not saying that parents can't have input in coaching their kids to be better athletes. Of course they can. You and I and many others got a lot of our development as young athletes from parents in our lives, right? But parents need to understand the context their child is operating in and when to give some input and when there should be a boundary and not give that input. And if they have a coach or an assistant coach who's that is their defined role, that is their job, respect and good, healthy boundaries is to say, I'm going to let your coach do that coaching and I'm not going to do it, right? So I think that's the most common. And like I said, it's kids who end up having negative experiences when those boundary lines get blurred and parents or family members are stepping too far into that setting.
Mike Matheny, as many know, was a St. Louis Cardinals catcher in the early 2000s, and he later served as the team's manager from 2012 through 2018. And I visited about this a little bit before in different shows on Main Street, but he famously said he would prefer to coach a team of orphans because parents are often the biggest problem in youth sports. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, that was... That was a memorable statement, of course. But this is one of the central points of conversation we had when we talked about parents and healthy boundaries with parents in youth sports, is often a coach, especially if they're going into a season, they will have the mindset, I'm gonna have to deal with parents. And so the mindset of I'm gonna have to deal with parents means that relationship, that expected interaction with parents is characterized by frustration and by the expectation it's that my interaction with parents is going to be about concerns, conflict, and maybe even confrontation. And I dread that. I hate that. You know, that's the worst part of my coaching experience. I love these kids. I love giving them an opportunity in sport. I love seeing them grow. But man, if I have to deal with one more parent who's going to be a headache to me, I just am not sure I want to do the experience, right? And so part of what we talked about was, is it important for us to maybe shift that mindset from dealing with parents to working with parents, taking steps early on when you are working with youth, if you're becoming a coach, if you're going into a season, to see parents as potential partners and allies. And remember, parents and their family members, they're often the biggest voice about our players and our team to the community. You know, they love to say, hey, my child went and they participated in this game, they did a great job, the team was super, or they might, you know, post criticism. And so you'd rather have them as a positive voice for your program and your players rather than a negative voice. But that takes some planning and some proactive effort with those parents to communicate expectations about our culture and how we can work together and we can cooperate and be considerate of each other in supporting these players and this team rather than the opposite. So I think it requires some really proactive efforts on the part of coaches and on the part of parents to have a different mindset that this is our team and our culture, and we each are going to have a role in that. And we need to talk to each other about what that appropriate role is, where the boundaries are, what the expectations are, things like that. And I think that that helps to hopefully shift that mindset of like, hey, I'd rather coach a team of orphans than a team of kids who have parents there to, you know, scream and carry on from the sidelines and abuse the refs or whatever might happen.
For listeners who are interested in reading what Mike Matheny has to say about this, it's a 7-page PDF that's available on the internet. Just Google Matheny Manifesto. You can also buy the longer book, and it's available online as well. Another thing that Mike Matheny said was a parent's role at the game is to clap. That's it. Nothing more. Do you agree with that?
I don't know that I would go quite as far as Mike Matheny with respect to that, because a parent's role might be to bring treats. A parent's role might be to provide rides. A parent's role might be, I mean, there's actually a lot of ways that a parent can contribute proactively in a positive way to the culture and success of a team without assuming the role of some sideline coach that's infringing upon the boundaries that need to be there with respect to how coaches are interacting with players. So I would say in that sense, you know, let's think broadly about what parents might bring to the table and contribute and set boundaries. And, you know, boundaries are expectations, high standards of like, this is how we expect you to behave. This is what we encourage. And then this is how we expect you not to behave. This is what we discourage, right? And so I think having that conversation with parents early on and in a couple of meetings, talking about that, what do you want for your child this season? How can we work together to accomplish that? What's your role in doing that? What's our role as coaches in doing that? Again, it's some preventive work. It takes some effort, but I'll tell you a quick story. So I grew up cheering for a hometown basketball team. I was a fan. I'd go with my dad to the games. He had multiple tickets, so sometimes I'd sit with my friends. And anyway, so one game I was sitting apart and my friend had a pair of binoculars and he looked over and I had this uncle who was a former military guy who'd come to the game. And he was looking over where my dad was. He said, "Hey, your uncle's getting in a fight." And I said, "What?" So there was a fan who always sat behind us and he was just a very, we'll just say a very verbally loud and abusive fan, always to the refs and the players, things like that. And my uncle happened to turn around and he'd never been to this sporting venue before, but he turned around and he punched this guy in the mouth and he got escorted out, all this stuff. But here's what was telling. The next game, the quote, offending fan tapped my dad on the shoulder and my dad turned around and said, "Hey, what can I do for you?" And he said, "Was I really that bad?" And my dad and the other fans around looked at him and said, "Yeah, you really are that bad." And he said, "I never really realized how bad I was. I apologize." And his behavior from that point was different. And my point from that is it's hard for parents to act differently if they're not taught and coached. And sometimes you're going to have to do some communication of expectations of behavior to parents and coach them up a little bit, just like you have to coach up kids. And you know, some parents have grown up in the context of youth sports and how you behave. Some haven't. It's their first kid, or maybe nobody's ever really told them clearly in a way that these are the expectations. And so I think that's really an important part of the equation, is being able to define and communicate what those expectations are.
We're enjoying our conversation with NDSU professor and Extension Family Life Science Specialist, Dr. Sean Brotherson. We're talking about boundaries in youth sports. Before we started our interview today, we were talking about cell phones and social media and how those things didn't exist years and years ago. Are the problems that are manifesting, have they always been there? Now we're just seeing them. What's your take on the history of how the problems that now we see today via social media and other means are kind of constantly being thrown at us?
Yeah, I mean, I think the behaviors have always been there to a degree of, you know, depending on what we're talking about. But if we're talking about parents who get overly active on the sideline or in the stands, talking to the referees, talking to players on the other team, talking to coaches, things like that, and going beyond boundary lines where they're making themselves part of the game rather than being a fan of the game, I think those things have long been there. Although I think the boundary lines about that we've gotten more rough and coarse, and you know what people seem to think is acceptable behavior that is not. But the ability to capture those incidents on social media and broadcast them immediately to the world is different today. It was one thing when a sideline camera could catch, you know, the famous basketball coach Bobby Knight, you remember the incident, grabbing a chair and throwing a plastic chair across the floor during a game, and like, you know, that incident was kind of etched in basketball history as like, whoa, that coach has kind of violated a boundary. It goes beyond what we would expect, right? But it's different when all 15,000 fans in the stands for that game could pull out their camera, take a picture of it, put it on the internet, put their own commentary on it, and like blow it up as a much bigger concern, right? And so I think part of the conversation has to be conversation about, hey, boundaries about social media. How do you post about this team? How do you support us? Don't criticize and undermine, you know, the team. I mean, and there's actually more and more incidents of young players in sports situations in high school or even younger being caught between parents and coaches or administration where they're being undermined by parents posting social media things and criticizing the coach and trying to, you know, gin up problems and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, you got to have some conversation about that too. How are we going to support this team on social media? And having an expectation, one of the things I communicated was that we positively comment and promote the team, the program through social media. We avoid criticizing players, fellow parents, family members, coaches, or the team and program on social media. And you just say, this is a boundary for us. This is an expectation. We want your positive support, but we expect you not to, you know, if you have a complaint, come to us and if we have to go to work with administration to work something out, we will try to do that. But I think that's really important. Inflaming things on social media doesn't tend to make things better in any particular situation.
If you could give one set of advice to parents of young athletes here in North Dakota, what would you tell them?
Yeah, I tell them to think about what is the legacy that you want to leave for your child's experience in youth sports. Do you want it to be a legacy of disappointment? Do you want it to be a legacy of frustration because you didn't follow healthy boundaries yourself in how you supported them or encouraged them? Or would you want it to be a legacy of celebration of their positive experiences in youth sport? You know, I told a story about my uncle. He was a youth basketball coach at the high school level in Southern Nevada, and coached basketball, baseball, softball, volleyball. I mean, he coached a bunch of things. And a few years ago, he's passed away now, but a few years ago, his high school named the gymnasium after him. And we talked about that, and I said, how does that happen? It doesn't happen by accident. He won 13 state championships in basketball. And I had a chance to be coached by him a little bit. And let me tell you, it was not a win at all costs attitude. And so his players and the community, of course, they remember the state championships. But I don't think that's what they remember the most. I don't think they would have named the court after him, you know, just because of that. What they remember was his positive influence, him making a difference in the positive development of so many young people, young men and young women who came through the sporting programs at that high school. So as a parent, think down the road, beyond this game, beyond this practice, think about what is the legacy I want my child to have in terms of an experience. And how am I contributing to that? And if what they're getting, you know, out of the memory is like, you know, I mean, my daughter sometimes tells me, Dad, I remember you during my youth soccer games running up and down the sideline. And I think about that and I'm like, I was pretty young back then. I think I've changed quite a bit as a parent and I've done a lot of youth coaching too. But I'm like, yeah, is that her main memory? But, or is it like, hey, did she feel like encouraged and supported by me as she was participating in that sporting activity? And I remember her running cross country and I was running around there, but I would run from place to place on the cross country course to cheer her on and her teammates as they ran by. So I kind of had to evolve as a parent, you know, in support of her. And that's what you want to think about is how can I grow and contribute in a way that my child will have be able to celebrate their experience in youth sports and the way I supported them in doing that rather than the opposite.
As we wrap things up, Sean, one of my great memories of my kids' high school career is my daughter had a veteran coach in soccer. And when the game started, the lawn chair was folded and he sat down in it. He stood up at halftime, talked to the team. And when the second half started, he sat back down in his lawn chair. Didn't say boo, except to maybe make a substitution on it. And I asked him about that later on. And he said, my job is to coach during practice. If I haven't coached during practice, it's too late. It's too late for me to do it in the game. And I thought that's really interesting because you just don't see that modeled, at least from my perspective, very often.
Yeah. And even, you know, even during in-game incidents, I mean, I was watching the national NCAA basketball championship just, you know, several years ago. And one of the teams competing was Gonzaga and their head coach, Mark Few, is a well-known, famous coach. And there was an incident during the game, right towards the end of the game, when his star player had something that kind of went wrong a little bit. And it was like a really tense moment, like the national championship is hanging in the balance. And Mark Few got that player on the side and, you know, and he was on one knee and he just had his arm around him. And you could tell he was talking to him. He wasn't cursing that guy up and down. He was just like, hey, it's all right. Let's get our heads together. And I was just like, what a model of coaching discipline and power, you know, and contribution. Like, I mean, you just have to see those moments and see, yeah, that's what we want to develop towards. And we have to sometimes be forgiving with each other when, hey, we get excited about, you know, plays and what's happening on the field and stuff like that. But youth sports is an amazing context for the development of young people. I mean, I developed in so many ways because of my involvement in youth sports, and there's other contexts, many others, drama, theater, I mean, other things where kids can develop, but youth sports is the one we're talking about. And making sure that we have supportive environments with supportive mentors and adults, making this experience the best it can be for the development of kids. I think that's really what we want to focus on and remember when we're involved in these venues, right?
My guest has been Sean Brotherson. He's an NDSU professor and Extension Family Life Science Specialist at North Dakota State University. Sean, it has been a pleasure, and this is an important topic, and we'll continue to visit about it here on Main Street. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Craig. I appreciate the opportunity.
Still to come on Main Street, Tom Ezern unearths the forgotten paper trail of Prairie Power in Mr. Power's letterpress. plus vanishing Burr Oaks, wave-powered villages in Alaska, and the curious connections between tomatoes, potatoes, and climate tech. That's all ahead. Stay with us. Main Street continues on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Historian Dr. Tom Easern cracks open the delicate pages of the past, literally. In the 1870s, before carbon paper or photocopiers, corporate managers used screw presses and tissue paper to preserve their handwritten letters. Among them was J.B. Power, architect of Bonanza Farming in the Red River Valley. Thanks to a trove of his letterpress copybooks acquired in the 1950s, we can read between the translucent lines of how corporate agriculture took root on the prairies.
In the early days of the Institute for Regional Studies at NDSU, established in 1950, the country's oldest academic studies center for the history of the Great Plains, there were certain faculty members of the AC who demonstrated a truly entrepreneurial spirit, doing wonders with really no appropriated budget. Chief among these was an English prof named Leonard Sackett, a legendary collector of manuscripts. I'll write more about him another day. But now let me dive into the boxes of what he considered his greatest acquisition, the papers of J.B. Power, acquired from Ayers in 1955. This manuscript collection, number 309, about 3.5 shelf feet of records, much of which consists of artifacts utterly foreign in form to readers of the 21st century. I'm talking about letterpress copybooks, a technology for the preservation of pen and ink letters in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Letterpress copybooks are a wonder to behold and to hold, a portal to a world where handwritten correspondence, which we think quaint and charming, useful for sentimental personal notes, that sort of thing, where handwritten correspondence directed the affairs of armies, nations, and corporations. It has been my pleasure and consternation as a historian to work through many of these letterpress copybooks, which are defined thus by the Society of American Archivists. Bound volumes of tissue paper containing reproductions primarily of correspondence made directly from the originals using a transfer process involving moisture and pressure in a copy press. Now, that's rather terse, and so I turn to the work of communications historian Joanne Yates, Control Through Communication, The Rise of System in American Management, Johns Hopkins University Press. Yates explains that letterpress copybooks became fixtures in managerial offices by the mid-19th century. Military commanders of a certain rank used them during the Civil War. I have pored over them in the records of the Department of the Upper Missouri during the Dakota War of the 1860s in the National Archives. Railroads, because of the complexity of their operations and their need for coordination, also eagerly deployed this communication technology. With a letter press, which was a screw press, the sheets of tissue paper were smashed down on the wet ink original letter to make copies. Copies thus would be read through the paper, hence the need for thin tissue. This brings us back to J.B. Power, the father of Bonanza Farming in the Red River Valley of the North. We know the details of how he brought about Bonanza Farming through his letterpress copybooks, which we have by virtue of the founding of the Institute for Regional Studies by Dean Hans Giesecke in 1950 and the assertive acquisition work by Professor Leonard Sackett in 1955. Encountered on a reading room table, these papers seem impossible to use. They are not. Stop by sometime. I'll show you how it's done. But as we labor to decipher details on the pages, we ought not to forget what they represent. Dirt farmers in those days, the 1870s, were literate letter writers, but they did not have letterpress copybooks. Corporate managers like Power, Land Commissioner for the Northern Pacific Railway Company, did. These copybooks represent the imposition of corporate agriculture on the prairies. Power, truth be told, had mixed feelings about what he wrought upon the land. This, too, is worth talking about.
That was Plains historian and our great friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, with Mr. Power's Letterpress. These ghostly impressions from the past remind us that paper and pressure once shaped both communication and the land itself. You can find more of Tom's work with the Institute for Regional Studies at NDSU, where prairie history is still pressed into view, and here at Prairie Republic, where he contributes these Plains folk essays. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Years of relentless drought are taking a toll on one of the Midwest's most iconic trees, the towering bur oak. At Nebraska's Mahoney State Park and beyond, vast swaths of forest as southern tree disease marches north. In this story from Harvest Public Media, Jackie Areta explores how climate change, pests, and pathogens are transforming the landscape and how foresters are rethinking which trees will survive in the Great Plains of tomorrow.
At the base of the observation tower in eastern Nebraska's Mahoney State Park is a graveyard where giant bur oak trees once stood.
They were dying from the tips down, and we noticed in this specific area it was almost a wedge effect.
Horticulturist Noah Sundberg had to remove 75 trees here last winter. He cares for the park's trees and first started noticing dieback in 2023.
It looked like it was one tree, and then it kind of spread in the direction of the predominant winds.
The widespread mortality was first a mystery to park officials until tests confirmed a disease-causing fungus was running rampant. Hypoxylin canker is a normal part of a tree's bark, but the severity of Nebraska's five-year drought is making trees much more vulnerable.
We're seeing change at an accelerated rate that they can't adapt as readily. So these 150, 200-year-old oak trees just can't handle the conditions of today.
The U.S. Forest Service, in a 2023 report on forest insects and diseases, said climate change is dialing up the effects that disturbances such as fires, flash floods, and drought have on trees across the country. And in turn, pests and pathogens have more opportunity to attack. Hypoxylin canker is common in the South following periods of drought. Clarissa Balbian, a diagnostician and lab manager with Mississippi State University, has dealt with it a lot.
By the time you've seen it, the tree has been under stress for so long that it's probably irreversible at that point. It's just in a decline spiral.
She helped horticulturists in Nebraska identify the disease, but it's also recently affected trees in other Midwestern states, like Kansas and Iowa, after extremely dry periods. Following the 2012 drought, University of Illinois forestry and research specialist Chris Evans saw thousands of oaks die.
We had whole swaths of acres of trees die at times.
Before that, Evan says he hadn't seen much widespread hypoxylin canker cases in southern Illinois. Nearby Missouri suffered similar oak decline following that historic drought.
It was just constant calls about why is my tree dying? What's wrong with my tree? A lot of trees died for us over a bigger area.
At the time, he recommended property owners replant with trees that could survive a future with less water.
Instead of a pin oak, maybe think about a black oak or, a white oak, or move over to other species in general, things like maybe black gums. Some of the hickories are more resistant as well.
Nebraska City, a town designated as a tree city of the world and the founding home of Arbor Day, is also figuring out how to hold on to the town's tree canopy during drought. For Rob Schreiner, arborist and chairman of Nebraska City's Tree Board, it's hit close to home.
I've lost two in my yard this year, and one of them is it was absolutely gorgeous last year, showed no signs.
Now he's introducing newer species to town that may have better luck through wild swings in weather.
I'm doing a lot of experiments now with the Japanese maples, having really good luck with those. They've come out with some new hybrid elms, which so far have been out for quite a while, and they're really doing well.
While more oaks are set to come down throughout Nebraska's state parks this winter, their stories may not be completely over. Months after forestry crews cut and burned the dead oaks in one park, they noticed resprouts starting from several stumps, sowing hope that the mighty native Nebraska oaks might one day return. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jackie Areta.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As rising seas threaten many indigenous communities, two villages in Alaska's Kenai Peninsula are considering a project that would harness the power of ocean waves for much-needed energy. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Waves gently hit the shores of Kachemak Bay as ravens croak above on a cloudy night in July. The small village of Port Graham is nested here at the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. The village has recently started to look at waves a little differently and may soon convert wave energy into electricity. Danielle Malchev is the first chief of Port Graham.
Energy through waves, it's convenient for us because that energy source is coming from our ocean.
I have a lot of hope that this is going to be something great for our community.
Chugachmut is a consortium that serves native tribes in South Central, including Port Graham and its neighbor, Nanwalik. The consortium announced it had partnered with an Australia-based company, Carnegie Clean Energy, in May to explore an ocean wave energy project for both villages. The initiative is years away and would cost more than $100 million in total, but it could be a new way for coastal villages to get reliable electricity at a lower cost. Carnegie has several wave energy projects across the world, including Australia and Spain, but this would be the company's first commercial installment in the U.S. That's according to Louise Richardson, Carnegie's commercial analyst. Richardson says Port Graham and Nanwalik might be perfect candidates for the installment because of their location.
One thing at Carnegie that we hope our technology will be able to service in the future is remote communities and isolated communities that might not have access to other forms of renewable energy options.
Port Graham and Nanwalik have no roads connecting them to the rest of the state. Energy costs there are high because the villages are at the edge of the grid and diesel for a backup generator comes on a barge. Plus, according to Chugachmut, the electrical lines running from Homer are several decades old, don't have enough capacity, and are unreliable. Malchev with Port Graham says the village loses power several times a month in winter and once every few months in summer.
Without power, we cannot make those connections to the people outside of our village. And this strains us in so many aspects, just in our normal lives.
Malchev previously worked as a health aide and is now a community health representative for the village. She says outages also make work at the clinic harder.
Say we had an emergency and we have to use satellite phones if our power is out, which isn't very convenient when you're trying to relay and talk to doctors in the ER and you're dealing with a patient at that time.
Malchev says more reliable electricity from wave energy could solve some of those issues. And ideally, the villages can sell any extra energy back to the grid and use that revenue on healthcare and education. The plan is to place a wave energy device offshore from Port Graham by Flat and East Chugach Islands. The device will be submerged and tethered to the seabed, moving with the waves and converting power from that motion into electricity. Villages on shore would receive the electricity through underwater cables.
That's what we need for our communities, because it generates its own power.
Phyllis Wimberly is the deputy director at Chugachmut. She says the first step is to ensure the location will work for the project. Wimberly says the consortium is planning to install test buoys by September. The villages will also need to upgrade their electrical system to increase capacity and have a way to plug into the wave energy unit. Wimberly says the consortium plans to invest $60,000 into the first stage of the project. They are also working to get additional funding from other sources. One federal grant they applied for was terminated in May, but Wimberly says Chugachmyut will continue its search.
Every time you go down a pathway and it's blocked, you have to go around, you have to go do something else. We're going to never give up.
Meanwhile, Wimberly says permitting, testing, and installation of the project might take close to 5 years. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
How your doorbell camera can save water. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
They're literally trying to tell us not to believe what we see with our own eyes if you look out your window.
That's what climate scientist Michael Mann told The Guardian after he read the Trump administration's new report that tries to justify rolling back climate regulations.
The report from the Energy Department was submitted as the EPA released a proposed rule last week to repeal the endangerment finding made in 2009. That said greenhouse gas emissions like CO2 and methane are dangerous to public health.
Included in the new report were conclusions that more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is good for plants and that sea level rise is not accelerating. Those findings have been widely criticized by scientists for being full of errors and cherry-picking data.
The Energy Department's report was drafted by five researchers who are known for questioning mainstream climate science. They claim, for example, that extreme storms such as hurricanes, tornadoes, and floods, as well as droughts, are not increasing over the long term.
However, Jim Cosin, who was employed at NOAA, said the opposite is true. There are long-term trends showing that hurricanes are becoming stronger, longer, and intensifying more rapidly.
If anything, climate models are probably underestimating the effect of human-caused warming on extreme events, according to Mann.
Forests sequester about one-third of all human carbon emissions, helping to mitigate climate change by pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. However, according to a new study, those trees don't work alone. They rely on animals to help save us from global warming.
Forests provide food and shelter to wildlife, but researchers from MIT say it's a two-way street. Animals eat fruits and nuts and then poop them out far from the tree, helping to germinate the seeds and extend the forest to new areas.
Fewer animals could mean fewer seeds being dispersed, which could weaken the climate mitigating power of woodlands. Research has shown that biodiversity worldwide is declining, so how much of an impact is the loss of wildlife having on carbon storage?
To find out, the team used data from more than 17,000 vegetation plots to analyze where wildlife dispersed seeds and how many they spread. They concluded that where animals had declined, forests lost the ability to absorb nearly 2 metric tons of carbon per hectare per year.
Reforestation is often cited as a way to mitigate the effects of climate change, but the authors say that planting trees costs money and also leads to less diverse forests. Animals, on the other hand, naturally plant trees for free.
In a nutshell, so to speak, to protect forests and their climate benefits, we need to preserve the habitats of seed-dispersing animals and provide wildlife corridors to reduce the impacts of human activities.
And finally, you say tomato and I say potato? I can because a new study has revealed that the humble spud we love to mash, fry, and roast evolved from the tomato 9 million years ago.
A team led by the Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences says potatoes are the result of a chance encounter between ancestors of the modern tomato and a group of plants known as the A. tuberosum, a potato-like species.
Back then, the plants lived in very different environments in South America. The tomato liked hot and dry places, while the potato predecessor preferred temperate conditions.
The stage was set for the two to meet when the Andes Mountains rose rapidly during an era when tectonic plates were actively shifting.
While neither of the parent plants on their own could make tubers, the underground organ that stores water and nutrients that we like to eat, the combination of their genes meant their offspring could.
The new tuber lineage that would eventually become our modern potato also used its parents' traits to survive in the colder and drier conditions arising at the time.
There are now more than 100 wild potato species, plus our common potato, that originated in South America. Understanding how potatoes evolved could ultimately help scientists breed more resilient versions that are resistant to disease and shifting climate conditions.
Better than that, we may now finally understand why some people like ketchup on their fries.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I like tomato, I like tomato, potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Daper for August 5th. In the summer of 1861, Secretary of the Treasurer Salmon P. Chase approached Congress. He could clearly see that the Civil War was going to be expensive. He said he needed $320 million over the next year. He thought he could come up with $300 million through existing taxes and the sale of public lands, and he left it to Congress to find the remaining $20 million. The House Ways and Means Committee proposed a bill to tax personal and corporate incomes. The details of the bill were hammered out over the next year, and on this date in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the country's first income tax into law. It called for a 3% tax on incomes between $600 and $10,000 per year, and a 5% tax on higher incomes. The war was, as Chase predicted, hugely expensive. In 1864, the rates were adjusted, 5% on incomes from $5,000 to $10,000, and 10% on anything higher. While there were some complaints that the tax was unconstitutional, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to impose and collect taxes. The focus was, of course, on the states that remained in the Union. Citizens of the Confederate states clearly wouldn't be lining up to pay the new tax. But it was questionable whether the income tax would apply to people living in Dakota Territory. On one hand, the tax law didn't explicitly include territories. On the other hand, territories were subject to federal laws, which would suggest the income tax could apply. The federal government did appoint tax collectors in Dakota Territory, but being appointed and actually collecting taxes were two very different things. Collection was difficult due in large part to vast distances and remote geography. Towns were small and widely scattered. Settlers lived on isolated farms. Much of the territorial economy was based on barter. Tax collection was hit or miss at best. In the end, Chase was right about how expensive the Civil War would be. In the first year alone, federal spending increased by over 2,000%. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Yeah.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on this show, we'll break down today's Minot's mayoral election with podcaster and columnist Rob Port. He'll help us understand what this election might mean for Minot's future. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.